Business is only the tip of the iceberg, according to Greg Palast. So we're going to hear about that. And the anniversary of the Gulf War gives us occasion to hear a long essay, well done, by Jeremy Scahill from The Intercepted. So that's what's happening in the next hour. And as I mentioned on the last bit of the Higher Ground show, we're going to go to Democracy Now! For some coverage of the march in Washington. Like I said, if you're shut in, you're wearing a sling, got a bunion, can't make it out on the road, you can check that out and see what's going on. I just noticed that there are some apps for following the march on Washington. There's an app about how to make a protest sign, which I didn't think you needed, but maybe they have some tips. Okay, we're going to kick it off with Amy Goodman's essay. We missed last week because she hadn't committed the essay to audio. I encourage you to read it. It's about Gina Aspel, our prospective torturer head of the CIA. But don't have time to get to that. Probably I'll truncate Gareth Porter's interview, which is more historic, from Flashpoints at the end and play the entirety tomorrow between 5 and 6. But I'll let you know where you can find it. So, counting the pain. Maybe that's what this one is. Forget what the headline of Amy Goodman's essay is.
The U.S. war in Iraq, 15 years and counting, the dead and displaced. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 15 years have passed since President George W. Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and a coterie of neoconservatives enabled by mainstream media cheerleaders launched the invasion of Iraq with a murderous bombardment of Baghdad they branded shock and awe. Far from delivering the promised freedom and democracy and exposing stockpiles of weapons of mass destruction, the illegal war killed, wounded, and displaced millions of civilians. More than 4,500 U.S. service members were killed, seven of them as recently as last week. Death and destruction on this scale would be more than enough to crush any society. Yet the Iraqi people have persevered, countering war with determination and hope.
We have to name it as, you know, a criminal war, the destruction of Iraq as a functioning state and society.
That's Zahra Ali speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour. The French-Iraqi sociologist was raised in Paris because her Iraqi parents fled Saddam Hussein as political exiles.
The post-2003 Iraqi regime has proven, you know, to be very anti-democratic.
Matt Howard enlisted in the Marines before September 11, 2001.
I watched the invasion from Okinawa, Japan, where I was stationed at the time, and had a real kind of gnawing sense of dread that we were making a decision we could never step back from.
Speaking on Democracy Now!, Matt described being deployed twice to Iraq in 2004 and 2005. By 2008, he was back in the U.S. opposed to war. He joined Iraq Veterans Against the War and now is co-director of the group, which recently changed its name to About Face.
I really went down a path of challenging everything that had been told to me was when we were guarding Iraqi men who are laborers that were coming onto our forward operating base, who basically spelled out everything Zahra said, that their lives had measurably, the quality of life had taken a dramatic hit, and that everything that we were being told in terms of our, you know, hearts and minds and how we're going to make this place better is far from the truth as could possibly be.
Iraq Veterans Against the War organized a march in 2012 to confront a meeting of NATO generals held in Chicago. Scores of decorated veterans marched to the gates of the meeting site, and each in turn made a statement against war, hurling their war medals over the fence.
Deployments occurred many times for some folks, sometimes as many as 10 times.
Again, Matt Howard.
The kind of invisible wounds of the war, as you were mentioning, whether that's post-traumatic stress, traumatic brain injury, or military sexual trauma, that are often not tallied in the kind of figures that, we have for these things. And just want to make it clear that if that goes to for the military, that very definitely goes for the Iraqi civilians that are continuing to deal with the after effects of this war.
One person confronting these after effects is Sami Rasooli. An Iraqi native, Rasooli immigrated to the United States and over 30 years became a successful restaurateur and beloved member of the community in Minneapolis. After the U.S. invasion of his home country in 2003, he formed Muslim Peacemakers and moved back home. He's been living in Najaf ever since. Listen carefully to Sami Rasooli. We're speaking to him on a crackly phone line in Najaf, Iraq.
Iraq entered in a tunnel in 2003, with no light at the end, from the invasion to occupation to sectarianism, then terrorism, ISIS, and we should not forget about Iranian expansion in Iraq. As a Muslim peacemaker team, been working since 2005 now in form of outreach and advocacy for peace and promoting the principles of peace building throughout the country between all factions, regardless whether they are Kurds, Arabs, Sunni, Shia, Muslims, or Christians.
Sami Rasooli's latest project is creating person-to-person connections to foster reconciliation between Iraq and the United States.
I started the school, as I said, about 6 months ago, trying to bring from so-called infidels from the West to meet so-called terrorists in the East, in Iraq mainly, according to the American mainstream media, to meet around on a round table, break the bread together, see in the eyes, and they will find out nothing of that nonsense is true. They are nothing but brother and sister, meeting, belonging to the same human race, and striking agreement by establishing lasting friendship that based on respect, mutual understanding, and trust.
Zahra Ali studies feminist and women's equality in Iraq and sees enormous obstacles to securing full citizenship for Iraqi women. But she says,
despite the very terrible situation, we do have very strong social movements. We do have, you know, citizens more recently, you know, since 2015, we have like a very strong grassroots popular movements that, you know, question the very legitimacy of the post-2003 regime.
Anniversaries afford a moment to reflect, but also to look forward. 15 years after the calamitous invasion of Iraq, those who precipitated the war still walk free. But those most deeply affected, from Iraqi civilians to U.S. veterans, are organizing against tremendous odds for peace. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay, now we're going to go to her mentee. I guess that's a word. Jeremy Scahill cut his teeth at Democracy Now! When it was at the Firehouse, I believe. Worked with the video guy there, too, that did some documentaries out of New York City. Community Access. Speaking of Community Access, this is Weft. I go through my favorites, Flashpoints, Pacifica, Outside the Bubble, recordings, interviews, people you don't hear. I mentioned Gareth Porter was on Democracy Now! This week on another subject. We have him on Vietnam. And again, I'll play that in its entirety, Perils of Dominance. I got that from JSTOR, and it looked like it timed out and disappeared. I didn't know books do that when they're on your e-books. Anyway, I'm supposed to be terse. Top of the hour next, we'll be going to Democracy Now!, be preempting Behind the News. I was going to let you know what topics he's covering, so you can find that yourself as a podcast. I won't play Stormy Daniels by Harry Shearer, but you can find that somewhere from his podcast. Well, without further ado, I'm going to hear this half-hour segment or so with Jeremy Scahill. And it starts out with this one of these little skits, little routines, little thought piece, little satire. And I think this is another one where I don't know the cultural reference that it's based on. So maybe you do.
Hello? Finally, the man at the helm of Cambridge Analytica, CEO Alexander Nix, has agreed to meet. In a phone call first to our fixer, the final sales pitch begins.
I'm just going to come out and say it. I'm ready to take on the Catalina wine mixer. I've been earning and burning, snapping necks and cashing checks, and I'm ready to nail it. I want it, okay? I want the Catalina wine mixer.
It would be our final meeting with Cambridge Analytica. This the man who in public eulogizes free and fair elections, but who in private, we're about to discover, appears to play dirty.
And what we want to know is, what is the expertise of the deep digging that you can do to make sure that the people know the true identity and secrets of these people?
Probably wondering why we gathered you here tonight. We thought we'd roll out a once-in-a-lifetime business opportunity.
Prestige. Worldwide. Why? Why?
Management.
Financial portfolios. Insurance.
Computers.
Black leather gloves.
Research and development, putting in the man hours to study the science of what you need.
Last week, we put liquid paper on a bee, and it died.
Security.
Security.
And. Investors? Possibly you.
So there you have it, the self-proclaimed digital masterminds. How much of this was hype? How much the truth?
We may never know.
This is Intercepted. I'm Jeremy Scahill, coming to you from the offices of The Intercept in New York City, and this is episode 49 of Intercepted.
There are reports that there is no evidence of a direct link between Baghdad and some of these terrorist organizations.
There are known knowns. There are things we know. We also know there are known unknowns. That is to say, we know there are some things we do not know. But there are also unknown unknowns. The ones we don't know, we don't know.
Excuse me.
This week marks the 15th anniversary of the 2003 U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq. And it's important that we examine what happened, how it happened, the lies, the crimes, the mass killings, the destruction, all of it. And George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and the neocons all should hold a special place in the hall of shame for mass killers, for what they did to Iraq. But they did it with the support of many in Congress, including some of the most prominent and elite Democrats. But I also believe that we need to understand how we got to where we are today in Iraq, because this is a classic case study in U.S. imperial crimes. And that means stepping back and examining a much broader history. It's a 55-year history that is filled with constant interventions and bombings and sanctions and covert CIA activity and regime change. And in this history, a history you never hear discussed on cable news, the main victims are, as they've always been, ordinary Iraqis.
The latest Middle East crisis, perhaps the most menacing of all, has flared up in Iraq, a country that produces over 30 million tons of oil a year. In this picture, King Faisal is at Kirkuk with his uncle, Crown Prince Abdul-Ilah.
July 14th, 1958, Baghdad, Iraq. Army Brigadier General Abdul Karim Qasim leads a military revolt against the British-backed Iraqi monarchy.
Without warning, revolution has swept away the young King Faisal of Iraq and his uncle Crown Prince Abdul-Ilah. Iraq becomes number one danger spot. Veteran Premier Nouri es-Said is deposed, he has fled, and the Republican rebels have offered £10,000 for his arrest. The tide of Arab nationalism is again in flood.
Facing almost no resistance, the Iraqi rebels seize key military and government installations in Baghdad and elsewhere in the country, and they declare an end to the era of the Hashemite royals, who ruled Iraq backed by the iron fist of Western colonial powers.
Our revolution is a real reaction against tyranny and corruption. We want to use our wealth to raise the standard of living of the people.
Abdelkarim Qasim declares Iraq a republic, and he consolidates power through a revolutionary council. Qasim and his allies create a structure for the Iraqi presidency, where power will be shared by representatives of the three largest groups in Iraq, the Shia, the Sunni, and the Kurds. Qasim becomes prime minister, and the new government begins to implement sweeping economic and political reforms. This new government seized nearly all of the land in Iraq that was controlled by the British-owned Iraq Petroleum Company and redistributed that land to Iraqi farmers. And Qasim pulled out of the U.S. and British-run Baghdad Pact, which was aimed at keeping the Soviets away from Middle Eastern oil.
At Lancaster House, London, representatives of five nations meet to discuss a crisis. Mr. Macmillan, who presided, opened the meeting with a tribute to King Faisal.
We meet today under the shadow of the recent tragic events in Iraq.
While the British and Americans began plotting to isolate and possibly remove Qasim, the new revolutionary government in Baghdad gained rapid, widespread support in the country. Laws on women's rights were passed, and amnesty was granted to Kurds who had engaged in uprisings in Iraq in the 1940s. Qasim also ended a ban on the Iraqi Communist Party. He pulled Iraq out of these security and military partnerships with the United States and other Western countries, and he normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Qasim openly backed Palestinian liberation causes and the Algerian resistance against the French. He also stated clearly that oil-rich Kuwait was part of Iraq and that its independence was a project of Western oil corporations. Qasim nationalized many of Britain's oil fields and formed a new Iraqi national oil company.
The storied capital city of Baghdad is the scene of the latest bloody coup d'etat, a demonstration of violent 20th century Arab tensions set against a way of life that has changed little since the Dark Ages.
The United States and Britain wanted Qasim gone, and the CIA, under John F. Kennedy, began working with Iraqi factions that the U.S. believed could help overthrow Qasim, namely the Ba'ath Party and one of its most vicious henchmen, a man who had actually tried to assassinate Qasim in 1959. His name, Saddam Hussein. And that assassination attempt failed. But a few years later, on February 9th, 1963, Abdelkarim Qasim was overthrown and he was executed after a bizarre show trial on Iraqi radio.
The storied city of Baghdad, capital of Iraq, has been the scene once more of bloody revolt that has seated a new government. For 5 years, General Abdel Qasim, Wright, ruled the country by armed might after he seized power by assassinating King Faisal and the Prime Minister. Now, like many before him, he has fallen as he rose violently. A pro-communist, Qasim dined before a firing squad in the wreckage of the Defense Ministry building.
As Saddam Hussein and the Ba'ath Party consolidated power, they massacred thousands of people, including a huge number of communists.
Army and militiamen carry on the search for communist infiltrators, over 100,000 of whom entered Baghdad during Qasim's regime. When they are found, the communists from other countries are deported. Native Reds, known for crimes perpetrated on behalf of Qasim, are sent before firing squads. As the Arabs show, they are more concerned about the dangers of communism than is realized by some Western leaders.
The interior minister of the new regime would later say that the Ba'ath Party came to power on a CIA train. Yes, a decade after overthrowing the democratically elected leader Mossadegh in Iran, the CIA played a similar role in toppling the Iraqi government, which, like Mossadegh, was unfriendly to colonial Western oil corporations. The CIA provided lists of people for Saddam and his men to exterminate. Those lists were compiled at CIA stations across the Middle East. Suspected communists, leftists, or supporters of Qasim were tortured and summarily executed.
The streets of ancient Baghdad become the scene of a short but decisive revolution that topples the pro-communist government of Premier Abdelkarim Qasim, shown here on the right. A six-man military junta seizes power on a holy day. And within hours, the premier, who reportedly had executed 10,000 people, is himself shot.
The U.S. and other Western powers characterized the overthrow of Qasim as a victory against Soviet incursions into the Middle East, and Washington responded enthusiastically to Qasim's downfall. The characterization that it was a massive blow to the Soviet Union became the dominant narrative, and the United States started to resume military aid to the new Ba'athist regime. By the time Saddam Hussein officially took over as the president of Iraq in 1979, the country was considered by the U.S. to be one of its most strategically important regimes in the Middle East, particularly after the U.S.-backed Shah was overthrown in neighboring Iran.
Khomeini, almost unknown outside of Iran just a few months ago, returned a hero, the man who from long distance had led the revolution to topple the Shah. Inside the airport terminal, Khomeini was greeted by scores of Muslim religious leaders and political allies. He called on Iranian Prime Minister Bakhtiar to resign and said all foreigners should leave the country. In an obvious reference to the United States, he said, "Foreign advisors have ruined our culture and have taken our oil."
When the Islamic Revolution of Iran happened in 1979, the Iran-Iraq War soon followed and would kill hundreds of thousands of people, some estimates say as many as a million dead. The United States supported both sides in that war, but no doubt wanted Iraq to win. Saddam was known as a brutal mass murderer, but that was preferable to Washington over an Islamic government. U.S. war planners gave Saddam Hussein targets to bomb throughout Iran. They poured weapons into the effort, and the Reagan administration removed Iraq from the list of state sponsors of terrorism so that the weapons could flow unimpeded.
Well, the Ayatollah is in a war. And if he's going to go on with provocative acts against us or anyone else, then he's running a great risk because we're going to respond.
After Reagan removed Iraq from the list of state sponsors of terrorism, the U.S. began increasing its military aid to Iraq, including selling Iraq attack helicopters, helicopters that were used in the most famous incident of the Iran-Iraq war involving chemical weapons. And that was when Saddam Hussein ordered the gassing of Kurds in Halabja. Donald Rumsfeld, who was a private citizen at the time, was tapped by the Reagan administration as a special envoy, and he traveled to Iraq in 1983 to deliver a gift to Saddam Hussein from Ronald Reagan. It was a pair of golden cowboy spurs.
Tell me what was going on during this
Where did you get this video? From the Iraqi television?
This is from Iraqi television.
When did they give it to you? Recently or back then?
We've dug this out of the CNN library.
I see. Isn't that interesting? There I am.
So what was going on here? What were you thinking at the time?
Well, Iraq was in a battle, a war with Iran. And the United States had just had 241 Marines killed. And President Reagan asked me to take a leave of absence from my company.
In that meeting, Donald Rumsfeld and Saddam Hussein discussed solidifying U.S.-Iraqi relations. And it was during this period when the U.S. was at its most cozy with Saddam Hussein that the Iraqi dictator was at his most brutal. He was a mass murderer, but he was Washington's mass murderer. It was only when Saddam Hussein decided to invade oil-rich Kuwait, a country that many Iraqis characterized as an oil field with a flag, that the U.S. posture changed. Suddenly, overnight, Saddam was being compared to Hitler, and George H.W. Bush launched a massive air attack on Iraq in 1991.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied Air Forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak. Ground forces are not engaged. This conflict started August 2nd when the dictator of Iraq invaded a small and helpless neighbor. Kuwait, a member of the Arab League and a member of the United Nations, was crushed. Its people brutalized.
Despite Bush's claim that the U.S.-led attack was aimed at the Iraqi military and Saddam Hussein, the Gulf War saw the United States bomb Iraq back centuries. Its civilian infrastructure was obliterated, its water treatment and sewage facilities destroyed. The U.S. also heavily used depleted uranium munitions that would later cause a skyrocket in cancer and birth defects. But George H.W. Bush decided to keep Saddam Hussein in power. Why? Because he was considered preferable to an Islamic government, particularly one that would have aligned itself with Iran. And so Saddam remained.
As Commander-in-Chief, I can report to you our armed forces fought with honor and valor. And as president, I can report to the nation, aggression is defeated, the war is over.
Under Bill Clinton, the U.S. imposed the most sweeping economic sanctions in modern history. It was tantamount to economic warfare, not on Saddam or his government or his henchmen, but on the Iraqi people. When the United Nations estimated that upwards of 500,000 Iraqis were killed as a result of the sanctions, Bill Clinton's Secretary of State, Madeleine Albright, defended it on 60 Minutes.
We have heard that 500,000 children have died. I mean, that's more children than died in Hiroshima. And you know, is the price worth it?
I think this is a very hard choice, but we think the price is worth it.
In addition to the sanctions that Madeleine Albright was defending, Clinton initiated the longest sustained U.S. bombing campaign since Vietnam, at some points bombing Iraq an average of once every 3 days throughout the 1990s.
My fellow Americans, this evening I want to speak with you about an attack by the government of Iraq against the United States and the actions we have just taken to respond. This past April, the Kuwaiti government uncovered what they suspected was a car bombing plot to assassinate former President George Bush while he was visiting Kuwait City. The Kuwaiti authorities arrested 16 suspects, including two Iraqi nationals.
In response to an alleged plot to kill former President George H.W. Bush, Bill Clinton ordered an airstrike in Baghdad that killed several Iraqi civilians, including the famed painter, Layla al-Attar.
Who killed this woman, this artist, this mother? Who broke the candle and snuffed out her light? Along with her husband and wounded her children and sauntered away like a beast in the night. Not I, said the soldier, I just followed orders. It was my duty to do my job well. Not I, said the leader who ordered the slaughter. I'm saddened it happened, but then war is hell. Not us, said the others who heard of the...
I can say from having spent extensive time in Iraq in the 1990s that its hospitals were like death rows for infants. There were no medical supplies. Birth defects that weren't found in modern medical journals were appearing. Syringes were being reused, and hospital floors were being cleaned with gasoline.
It's one of the crime, of the American crime. And if the Bush or Clinton, they know exactly what happened here, they hang themselves by themselves, I thought. And which crime were done by our children to receive this punishment? Only they are Iraq children, believe me. The most of the children dying because of the cancer, congenital malformation, malnutrition, they are a disease. And this is one of the weapons mass destruction against Iraq. This is not only use of chemical weapon, but also this is make everyone is illiterate, sick, and reduce the generation of the future. This is one of the mass destruction against Iraq.
A once secular society with advanced schools and progressive positions on women's rights relative to its neighbors, Iraq started to become much more religious. In 1998, Bill Clinton signed the Iraq Liberation Act, which was authored by the neoconservatives of the Project for a New American Century. Quite a few of the PNAC gang are now on MSNBC regularly, celebrating their principle in opposing Trump and never answering for their crimes in Iraq. But that legislation, signed not by Bush, but Bill Clinton, made regime change the law of the land. Even Bernie Sanders supported it.
The hard fact is that so long as Saddam remains in power, he threatens the well-being of his people, the peace of his region, the security of the world. The best way to end that threat, once and for all, is with a new Iraqi government.
George W. Bush and Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld came into power with a mission to overthrow Saddam Hussein. 9/11 was not even hours old when Rumsfeld started pushing to invade and attack Iraq, a nation that had absolutely nothing to do with 9/11. This push to war was aided by powerful media organizations that breathlessly reported on Iraq's weapons of mass destruction. Prominent Democrats and Republicans pushed this myth. Then FBI director and current special prosecutor Robert Mueller also pushed those lies in front of Congress. Former Vice President Joe Biden, who at the time was the chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, refused to call a single anti-war witness to the hearings that he conducted on the eve of the invasion of Iraq. And neocons like Paul Wolfowitz promised America that the occupation would pay for itself and go swimmingly.
These are Arabs, 23 million of the most educated people in the Arab world, who are going to welcome us as liberators. And when that message gets out to the whole Arab world, it is going to be powerful counter to Osama bin Laden. The notion that we're going to earn more enemies by going in and getting rid of what every Arab knows is one of the worst tyrants, and they have many governing them, is just nonsense.
This was an elite bipartisan beating of the war drum that culminated with Secretary of State Colin Powell's infamous speech at the United Nations Security Council.
We have firsthand descriptions of biological weapons factories on wheels and on rails. The trucks and train cars are easily moved and are designed to evade detection by inspectors. In a matter of months, they can produce a quantity of biological poison equal to the entire amount that Iraq claimed to have produced in the years prior to the Gulf War. Although Iraq's...
None of that, of course, was true. And 15 years ago this week, the U.S. began its invasion and occupation of Iraq with massive airstrikes across the country in an operation called Shock and Awe. Hundreds of thousands of Iraqis were killed throughout the course of the U.S. occupation. Millions were forced to flee their homes and the country. The U.S.-backed death squads and paramilitary militias conducted massacres in cities like Fallujah, encouraged sectarian battles. Mercenaries, including those from Blackwater, poured into the country, war profiteers, and Iraq became a massive killing field. But the image of Saddam's statue being pulled down in Firdaus Square helped the myth that victory was as simple as the neocons promised. And just months into the occupation, George W. Bush declared victory.
Thank you all very much, Admiral Kelly, Captain Card, officers and sailors of the USS Abraham Lincoln, my fellow Americans. Major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Despite this idiotic and sick display by George W. Bush, where he dressed up as a military pilot and stood in front of that mission accomplished banner on the warship, the war in Iraq was just starting. The viceroy that was sent to Iraq to run the Green Zone and the occupation, L. Paul Bremer, he was a neocon who profited off of risk insurance, and he made a series of disastrous and stupid decisions. His de-bathification edict resulted in 250,000 Iraqi soldiers losing their jobs. It wasn't long before they joined the resistance, and by the end of 2004, there were both Shiite and Sunni uprisings against the United States. It was at this point that large numbers of U.S. soldiers began to die. And in D.C., Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld were whistling past the graveyard and minimizing the anti-U.S. uprisings.
The level of activity that we see today from a military standpoint, I think, will clearly decline. I think they're in the last throes, if you will, of the insurgency.
The highest price for this invasion and occupation was, of course, paid by ordinary Iraqis. And it didn't take long after Saddam Hussein was executed, before his trials were even complete, for Saddam Hussein's popularity to rise. Many Iraqis hated Saddam, despised him, but they hated what the U.S. had done to their country even more. And that phenomenon continues to this day. In fact, Saddam has never been more popular.
We are in full agreement about how to move forward. So, today, I can report that, as promised, the rest of our troops in Iraq will come home by the end of the year. After nearly 9 years, America's war in Iraq will be over.
Barack Obama, who campaigned as an anti-Iraq war candidate, did pull most U.S. troops out of Iraq, but then he quickly changed course and sent thousands back as fighting intensified along the Iraq-Syria border. What the U.S. started in Iraq ultimately spilled over into Syria, and out of the ashes of a disastrous U.S. policy, ISIS rose. And some of their most sophisticated military operatives and strategists had been Iraqi soldiers fired by Paul Bremer in 2003 and 2004. At least one Iraqi general, a famous one, he was on the deck of cards that the U.S. military created for the kill-capture campaign of high-value targets. He had worked with the U.S. during the Iran-Iraq war. He ended up joining ISIS. And when Obama left office, there were more than 5,000 U.S. troops in Iraq and an expanding U.S. air war.
I had numerous conversations with Sean Hannity at Fox, and Sean Hannity said, he said, you were totally against the war because he was for the war.
Why is your judgment better than
that? That was before the war started. I was against the war. He said, you used to have fights with me because Sean was in favor of the war. And I understand that side also, not very much because we should have never been there, but nobody called Sean Hannity.
On the campaign trail, Donald Trump railed against the Iraq war, claimed he was always against it, which of course is not true, but he still managed to make some valid points during the campaign, albeit in a very Trump way.
George Bush made a mistake. We can make mistakes, but that one was a beauty. We should have never been in Iraq. We have destabilized the Middle East.
You still think he should be in peace?
I think it's my turn, isn't it?
You do whatever you want. You call it whatever you want. I want to tell you, they lied.
Okay.
They said there were weapons of mass destruction. There were none, and they knew there were none. There were no weapons of mass. Okay.
Despite all of Trump's rhetoric on the campaign trail, he came into office and proceeded to start ratcheting up the bombing in Iraq and Syria. He loosened rules on killing civilians, and the death tolls skyrocketed. Iraq today remains shattered and violent and dangerous and sectarian. and the U.S. continues to play a destabilizing role on top of the legacy of blood that it already created in Iraq. From the 1960s and the CIA working with Saddam and the Ba'ath Party, to the weapons, intelligence, and support for Saddam during the Iran-Iraq War, to the Gulf War and the destruction of the civilian infrastructure, to the sanctions and the no-fly zone bombings, to the lies about WMDs and the invasion of Iraq, from the stupidity of the neocons before and during the occupation to the massive refugee crisis caused by the war, U.S. policy has been consistent. For the past 55 years, there has been one central truth about the U.S. role in Iraq, and that is that it's been consistently anti-Iraqi people. Since the 1960s, U.S. policy under Democrats and Republicans has been about the interests of Western capitalism, and the flags of American victories have always been planted violently on piles of Iraqi corpses. To discuss, well, just the past 15 years since the U.S. invaded and occupied Iraq, and also the visit of the Saudi crown prince.
Mehdi Hassan's coming up next. I'm going to listen to that myself again. That's from the Intercepted podcast. That was amazing, it seemed to me. Well worth spending the half hour on it and having to truncate something next and having to be glib here, or terse, I guess, not glib. Going to hear something in a completely different tone. I promised some Greg Palast. He's doing another election protection bulletin because of all the brouhaha about Cambridge Analytics. He says it's only the tip of the iceberg. So we're going to hear this straight away and then get to some from Gareth Porter, author of Perils of Dominance, about Vietnam, talking about Miley. I met Democracy Now! As well as doing this 4-hour coverage of the March for Our Lives straight away is going to do a series on Miley. They already started. I'm hoping they get Cy Hirsch, who's sort of been abandoned by New Yorker and major media here. Has to publish in Der Stern, and London Review of Books was even apparently, don't know exactly what happened when they turned him down. So, here's Greg Palast and my man Dennis Bernstein from Flashpoints from Thursday, if you want to check it out or pass it on. And we should have it right here. I think there might be a bumper of some music here. I'll talk over it. Views and opinions expressed on the air solely those of the speakers, not necessarily represented those, so not necessarily solely either. President Trump made the announcement. Sledge Drive starts on Monday.
Departure was a mutual decision, according to one White House official. China has threatened to slap retaliatory tariffs on U.S. goods, including pork, apples, and steel pipe.
That is not the right item. I don't know exactly where that came from. I guess that was Deutsche Welle. And I had selected this one, Greg Palast. Yeah, and there is a little musical bumper, which I should have edited off. Again, this is from the Thursday edition. It's not going to be a weekly feature like it was before the election, where I played it every week. It's going to be occasional, but if news about election threats come thick and fast, I guess maybe it might even be biweekly or twice a week.
To Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Have you heard of this company, Cambridge Analytica? And there's another company working with them, Facebook. Well, our next guest says all that you've heard, all this to do, ain't nothing compared to what the bigger story is. Let me read you a little bit about what Greg Palast has written. There are two dangers in the media howl over Trump's computer gurus, Cambridge Analytica, the data-driven psyops company founded by billionaire Brown Shirts, the Mercer family. The story is that Cambridge Analytica, once directed by Steve Bannon, by shoplifting Facebook profiles to bend your brain, is some unique bad apple of the cyber world. Palast says that's dangerously narrow, a narrow view. Greg Palast, welcome back to Flashpoints. Could you expand the narrow view here? Jump on in.
Oh, boy. Okay, yeah, so we've got this bad apple, Cambridge Analytica. Very, very Steve Bannon-ish title, pretentious and nonsensical. And they have, believe it or not, shoplifted, destroyed your privacy by using subterfuge to get several million Facebook profiles, which is pretty funny given that people put out their profiles to be public. But Cambridge Analytica shouldn't scare you, just like Steve Bannon shouldn't scare you, despite his scary looks and sounds. What should scare you is I360 Themis. What should scare you is Data Trust. Now, who are these guys? These are the big daddies of Cambridge Analytica. These are the real data miners and real creepy outfits. I360 is a much bigger basically psyops privacy troll than Cambridge Analytica could ever dream of. And guess who founded and owns I360 Themis? 3, 2, 1. Yes, the Koch brothers, Dennis.
Oh, man, I am shocked. Well, let's just listen, because you get into this in the new version of The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. We've got a few seconds here. Let's listen. We'll come back and talk more, Greg. Stay tuned.
Data Trust, hourly tracking over 1,800 things about you, Mr. Voter, including the last time you downloaded porn, to whether you ordered Chinese food just before you voted.
I think that's creepy.
Mark Sweland is an expert for companies that live and die by their databases.
I360 Data Trust have literally thousands of data points on you, Greg Palast, and on me, and on everybody who's watching this film.
Wait, what's this I360?
Their databases would include trillions of data points on hundreds of millions of people.
Rove is partnered with this bigger voter surveillance system called I360. Who gets all that creepy data? Turns out I360 was founded by two brothers.
I want my fair share, and that's all of it.
So... the Koch brothers jump in, have been in doing the real data mining, which is not the stuff that we all, like idiots, put up on Facebook.
Yeah, what you put up on Facebook is, that is, okay, that's not really you. We all know that you've been cheating on that. That ain't really your picture.
I got three names on Facebook.
Yeah, the other thing is, but what the Kochs go after is something much dearer to your soul, your credit card history. They go to your purchase history. They go to your cable TV viewing history. Plus, unlike Cambridge, they have something called, which uses psychometric profiling. They are the Kochs use dynamic profiling, which means that they are watching the changes in your behavior at all times, like you heard. And that's a real example of whether you just ordered porn and got Chinese food before you voted. I was just looking at another one that they had today where they could tell if you were a person who goes fishing and is concerned about your weight. So they can get to your hot spots, but they can do more evil things. And this is the other problem. By the way, the second one, not quite as good as the Kochs. And by the way, that was the voice of Charles Koch saying, I got him on tape actually saying, I want my fair share, and that's all of it. And I always thought he meant money, but he doesn't just mean your money, all of it, but he also means your information, your entire, your soul inside out. They want that so they can control you. And the other thing that they can do with this information, which we discovered, is they can not only get you to, figure out ways to make you vote the way they want, but to get you figure out ways to make sure you don't vote. And this is the other danger.
So how do they do that?
Oh, there's a couple ways. Well, for example, directly with the spinoff of I360 Themis, one of their operators in the recall of Scott Walker, the right-wing governor of Wisconsin, they went to their databases, found the Democrats who are gun owners in rural areas and typically vote by absentee mail-in ballot. They got to those people and said, save your gun rights and mail in your ballot to this address by this date. It's important. It was the wrong address, and the date was too late to have your vote counted. Okay? Then they did the same exact trick in North Carolina, sending out to voters of color and others saying, here's where you send your absentee ballot, and here's the wrong date. Then they rolled it out even bigger across the South. So that's just straight vote theft, vote manipulation. But even beyond that, okay, they can also use psychological means to discourage you from voting, to confuse you about the facts. But the other is that then, of course, they use these computers for such things. And Karl Rove is great at this one. And remember, if you heard from the film, and that was expert Mark Sweetland, who's probably listening to this, he's a fan of yours, so they were using a system. Karl Rove has a company called Data Trust, which is also in this data mining profiling business. And one thing that they were doing is something called caging. Karl Rove was caging. What that means is he sends letters out from his databases to voters whom he knows won't be at their home address. Who's not at their home address at their registered voter address? Answer: soldiers, black college students on summer vacation, the soldiers away in Iraq and elsewhere. And that's what they were doing and sending out letters to people. That's called, and when the letters came back as undeliverable, do not forward, they came back to the Republican National Committee, which is, by the way, the main client of Data Trust. The letters would come back to the Republican National Committee, and the RNC would then challenge these voters as ghost voters, illegal voters, black students, soldiers away from their military base where they are registered to vote. By the way, you don't have to be living at your voter address if you're a soldier, if you're a student. This is the game. And they're also sending, by the way, letters to homeless shelters to get those people knocked off the voter rolls. So this is the type of direct nastiness that these guys use with these databases. And like I said, Cambridge is like the most benign, except they had a little side business. I should take note. My old station, Channel 4 Britain, went undercover, and they got the Cambridge Analytica guy said, well, if our databases aren't good enough, here's what else we can do. We can have hookers seduce your opponents, and we tape them.
Oh,
that's
nice.
A little side business.
Beautiful. Well, let me jump in there. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's Greg Palast. He is the filmmaker, the troublemaker behind The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. And this new edition of the film is going to be presented here in the Bay Area. We're delighted to welcome Greg back to another showing of the new version of a very important film, which is going to be part of your protection for the 218-220 for the elections coming up this year. And Greg, you say that I-360, they can track some 1,800 behaviors. Do they?
Yes.
You have a list 1, of those 1,800?
Yeah. 1,800 behaviors on about 250 million Americans, because they seem to have missed some of the instances.
And they just sort of run the numbers.
Yeah, and they're following you on 1,800 behaviors. So, that's more than your wife or husband knows about you. And so it's very easy to manipulate you, to play on your emotions, but even more to mislead you. And, you know, obviously that makes you a complete target of fake news. I will say Cambridge Analytica, at least in the secret tape recordings by Channel 4 Britain, also explained exactly how they do what Trump calls fake news, which is that, you know, they literally plant false stories, and they say that they can do it without anyone knowing that they've planted these stories. But what's important is not just planting stories. It goes specifically to you and your fears that they can tell from the profile that they've gathered about you. But like I say, they're peanuts compared to FEMIS and I-360 and the Kochs and to Karl Rove's Data Trust. And we also know that they use this information. They're using databases, for example, to purge the voter rolls, not just through caging, but they're now on this new trick of the alien voter hunt. And, we've talked about, and you'll see in the film, of course, Chris Kobach, Trump's vote thief in chief, who was head of his vote fraud committee, which, by the way, was dissolved. But I want to warn you, you'll see in the new version of the film, in the public eye, it was dissolved, this phony vote fraud commission. Unfortunately, it was dissolved in public, but then its work was shifted into the dark cave of the Department of Homeland Security. That's really dangerous, where they are looking for so-called alien voters. They have a computer program by a guy named Jesse Richman, which is looking for un-American names. And I kid you not. And in the trial last week of Kobach by the ACLU, which the national press ignored except for you, bless you, Dennis. You know, they were saying, they gave this guy Jesse Richman, the ACLU, said, well, what about this guy Carlos Murguia? Is he an un-American voter that you would tag? And he says, oh yes. I said, do you know that he's the judge in the next courtroom, who was born in Kansas City? This is what they are doing. It's very, very dangerous. And it's not just that they get, you know, the American media is all shaken up that they're taking your Facebook profiles, which are, after all, public documents or you make public. That's the least problem. We have a very, very serious problem with these guys deliberately abusing the voter rolls, blocking voters from voting, especially voters of color. This is how they win elections. This is how they do it.
Greg, what else are you monitoring in this context out there now? I know you've got irons in a number of fires as we approach the next set of elections. What are you looking at?
Well, there's two things. Not only am I looking at the thievery, of course, we've talked about cross-check where they say people are voting twice in two elections, a million voters. It would, you know, it's not a joke because they're actually targeting and removing voters. We're trying to expose that. That's one thing we'll expose in the film. But also very important is to understand the billionaires behind the steal. The Mercers aren't stealing votes because they want to win elections. They're stealing votes because they want to steal money. I mean, it's very, very, for example, the Mercers' big money comes from Renaissance Technology. They, Robert Mercer has made billions through market manipulations. But his money is almost untaxed because he uses a gimmick called carried interest. Donald Trump, weirdly enough, said this is an unfair billionaire's tax loophole. So why would Mercer back him? The answer is to own him, because once Mercer came in and put his Cambridge Analytica machinery behind him, he was able to get Trump to completely reverse his position when he actually wrote the tax bill. So that Mercer was protected. Mercer's actually facing a punitive tax penalty of some $7 billion from the IRS. And now Trump is letting him off the hook on this loophole that Trump himself, several times in the campaign, says, this is really unfair, as he puts it, so unfair, so unfair.
Yeah. That's from the Thursday Flashpoints. I guess the fastest way to get to it is flashpoints.net. It doesn't have Palace's name in the script there, but I want to hear at least a few minutes of the Gareth Porter interview I was talking about. We'll hear the entirety of it tomorrow. GregPalast.com, P-A-L-A-S-T, if you haven't gone there, and he's got his essay up about how the Cambridge Analytics is really the tip of the iceberg in this regard. But we're going to hear about 8 minutes, and then we'll go to the March for Our Lives, some hours of it through the afternoon. It actually starts at 2:30, and maybe it starts and ends at Douglas Park. I should have that detail in front of me, because I'm thinking of going, despite that I'm a little impaired.
And you're really worried about your family. Thank you.
I was supposed to pull that down and let it run for the bumper of music here while I'm talking and telling you. We'll play the rest of this tomorrow. Gareth Porter, he was on Democracy Now! This week talking about another subject, which was the rabid guy that will now be National Security Advisor. He couldn't get... It was a recess appointment for Bush. They say, you know, well, he was ambassador to the UN when he didn't want seven stories on the top. He thought that didn't matter if it was there or not. All right. You know who I'm talking about.
Gareth Porter. Gareth Porter is an independent investigative journalist and historian specializing in U.S. national security policy, and he won the 2012 Gellhorn Prize. Gareth, welcome back to Flashpoints.
Thanks so much for having me again, Dennis.
Well, it's good to have you with us, and we have been doing some reporting on My Lai, but I wanted to focus in with you. You've written a very important piece that focuses in on the Peers Commission and the real responsibility for the slaughter, which falls at the hands of General William S. Westmoreland, who was, in fact, the commander of U.S. forces there. Why don't you just remind people, we've been talking about it, but how do you see what happened in My Lai and other places in Vietnam as a sort of a precursor of U.S. policy? What happened there and how did it carry over?
Well, Vietnam was the first war in which the United States was supposedly fighting an insurgency, not a conventional war. Of course, they did do a conventional war, but, you know, it was very self-consciously being fought against a foe, that is the Vietnamese communist-led nationalist in South Vietnam, in South Vietnam, but supported by North Vietnamese in the later stages of the war, which was waging a guerrilla war, an unconventional war, which was highly political in character. And essentially what was happening there was that the U.S. command under General William C. Westmoreland discovered relatively early that they could not win this war without draining what they called, in some cases, they called it the rural sea in which the Vietnamese or the Viet Cong were swimming. The people who were fighting against the American troops were swimming, so to speak. And so what came out of that was a strategy that required that the civilians living in the Viet Cong areas, which, you know, areas which had been controlled for years by, first of all, the Viet Minh and later on their successors under the anti-communist regime in the south, the Viet Cong, those people were people who were politically supporting the people who were fighting against the Americans. And so Westmoreland and his command decided they had to be taken out. And so what we had was free fire zones or free strike zones, as they were called, that were created throughout the parts of South Vietnam where the Viet Cong were in control. And as a result, hundreds of thousands, I think even more than a million, well over a million South Vietnamese moved from their homes, from their villages into refugee camps. But hundreds and hundreds of thousands, certainly again over a million, remained in the villages and hamlets which were controlled by the Viet Cong and were, you know, their families were part of the Viet Cong movement. And this is really the problem that essentially produced the massacre at My Lai, because as I show in my piece, there was a strategy which was well understood by the commanders throughout South Vietnam, U.S. commanders throughout South Vietnam, that said the people who remain in those villages are they're supposed to move, and if they remain there, they are considered to be part of the enemy. They are they didn't use the term, of course, explicitly, but the essential point was that these civilians become fair game. Of course, fair game for airstrikes, but it was also suggested when you had ground forces moving into those areas that those civilians did not have the protection that, certainly under international law, they were afforded, but the U.S. did not follow that law.
Gareth Porter, tell us a little bit, 54321. Gareth Porter, tell us a little bit about Lieutenant General William Peers and the Peers Commission. Everybody thought this was the truth. This was the bottom line. Soldiers were indicted. There were court martials. He finally got to the bottom of it, and the American people knew what happened in My Lai. But that's not the case, is it? Tell us about this commission and what happened.
Right. The Peers Commission was a big part of the story of what happened in South Vietnam, because it really answered the question that everyone had. Well, you know, how serious a stain is My Lai on the American conscience? And what the Peers Commission did was to show that there was a cover-up by officers and enlisted men. Well, not the enlisted men weren't part of the cover-up, but the officers, as many as 25 of them, all the way up to General Coster, were guilty of having covered up the killings, the wanton killings of civilians at My Lai. And that really satisfied the need of the U.S. political system to know that it was not official policy, that this was a violation of official policy. But what we did not know at the time, but what I found out from an interview with General Peers' civilian legal advisor, Jerome K. Walsh, Jr., who was his special counsel, and was close to General Pierce. He was told by General Pierce at the time that Pierce was hoping to become the commander of the 8th Army in South Korea. That would have been a plum position for a general at his stage of his career.
Well, that's interesting, because apparently that's what they might be doing with Kelly, to finesse him out of the chief of staff office, I heard. Send him to Korea, where he can conduct operations, as they call them. Well, we're going to go to Democracy Now! Pretty straight away. I want to get this underwriting announcement in here, and we'll do that right now. My name is Paul Muth. Opinions here are those of the speakers, and I talk fast, too.
This hour of programming is sponsored by the listeners of WEFD and Dancing Dog Eatery and Juicery. Located in downtown Urbana and serving 100% vegan foods and juices, Dancing Dog offers a full menu of smoothies, lunch, dinner, and Sunday brunch options. Their menu consists of various items made in-house, including ketchup, plant-based cheeses, granola, and salsa. In a hurry with no time to sit down? No problem. Dancing Dog has a grab-and-go fridge offering